Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Business news, views, and insights from across the globe.
Welcome, everyone. Today in our virtual studio, we have Amasi Mwela, who is the CEO of Private Property. Amasi is an executive with extensive financial services experience. He has been working in a number of large institutions, and from my experience, really has a passion for challenging, for finding new and disruptive business models, and in enlisting his teams to do the extraordinary. Amasi, perhaps you can give us a little bit of an introduction onto yourself.
Hi, Sir, and hi, everybody. Thanks for having me today. Brief introduction. I have been in quite a few industries, as I was mentioned, everything from banking, insurance, travel. I've been around the block pretty much. I've done this kind of work for the last 15 years or thereabout. I have had about 7-8 years worth of senior management experience, and executive experience has been over the last 5-6 years. I've been privileged enough to work for some big companies within the country. I've been privileged enough to have the exposure to international markets through American Express. And I've been privileged enough to lead quite a few organizations and business areas through extensive times of change. Not anything even close to what we're experiencing now, but I must say there's a lot to learn for all of us. And for me, this is an exciting time and opportunity beckons.
That's great. You know, Amasi, one of the first words that kind of come to mind when I think about our work together and generally the work that you do more broadly is transformation. So not specific just to this particular crisis that we are navigating through, but you seem to be drawn into environments which seek, which call out, and where you have a mandate to transform an organization. So let me maybe start off with that. I mean, what brought you to Private Property? What made you think that this is the next challenge, the next area in which you can apply such a transformational mandate?
Well, about 2 years ago, I was sitting in the education space, having ridden out a really tough time there. That was the time I joined the education space at the time where there was a lot of unhappiness within the country and globally, I suppose, around models around student funding. So a lot of students are finding themselves in great debt. And I joined the education space literally 2 weeks before the country, South Africa specifically, began to experience a lot of change in the education space. So there was a lot of conversations at the time around student funding models. And for my sins, I went and joined a student funding organization. So literally within a couple of weeks of joining, we started to experience turmoil in the organization pretty much based on the environment and how everybody was being affected at the time around student lending. So we very quickly had to gather around and start thinking about what the new business model for this organization would look like, bearing in mind that what was the core of the business at the time had just been disrupted significantly. And because it was external factors, this is not anything that any of us could control. So, and very quickly, we started on that journey. It's been something that I've done for most of my career. Everywhere I've gone, for some reason, this stuff has found me rather than me finding it. But I just find that in the midst of turmoil, there's always opportunity. In the midst of chaos, there's always opportunity. And I seem to have developed an eye to see that opportunity, and joining Private Property from the education space was another step in that direction. This was an organization, we'd been speaking for a couple of months, and this was an organization that I saw as having incredible potential. A really, really good brand, a household name. There's literally very few people that can claim not to have heard of the name Private Property. And this was, for me, a brand that was just waiting to be awoken. So household name, household brand, everybody knew about it. And when I started having conversations with the people then there at the time, I just saw opportunity all around. I mean, we had at the time over 1 million customers coming to the website on a regular basis. And having been around the block and seen various industries, everything from travel to financial services to insurance, I know how difficult it is to get to that level of scale. But here's an organization that sat on 1 million users on a regular basis, had a very loyal base from an estate agent point of view, and had significant numbers of listings, and had almost reached a ceiling in terms of where the organization was going. So I looked at that from the outside. And as soon as I did that, I walked into this organization very hopeful that what we'd find here would be an incredible organization with massive potential. It turns out I was right. And we've been walking the journey since.
One thing you've alluded to is that initial impression that you had of the organization, both in your conversations even before joining the organization and as you started to meet the team and interact with them. Perhaps for the benefit of our listeners, tell us a little bit more about how did you go about diagnosing where private property was versus where it could be, where its potential was? What was that process like? Give us a little bit of a feel of what did you have to go through to come up with a conclusion that it could go much further than where the organization was.
So firstly, there's an external diagnosis, if you can call it that. So before you join an organization, you have no idea what the actual facts around the table are. And all I knew at the time was what I was being, you know, spoken to in the interview and all the conversations I had with board members, which is always one particular aspect. When you jump into an organization, I just always find that everything is quite different. So I remember one specific interaction while we were talking, and I hadn't yet decided to join at the time. They hosted, or they were part of a property expo. It was taking place in Sandton, a fairly sizable property expo at the time. And I paid them a visit, just a surprise visit to go and see what this organization was about. While I was there, there's an upstairs sort of view in the Sandton Convention Center. I looked down and I basically saw what was the property buyer show at the time. And there were thousands of people going from one stand to another, looking to understand more about property, looking to get a bit better understanding of how the property industry works. There was first-time buyers, there's all sorts of market segments. And when I went to the stand of the organization, what we were basically showing people is how our website works, etc. But what I saw there was the opportunity for this organization to sit at the center of this ecosystem. So what I saw was a physical manifestation of what the website probably looks like inside. Lots of people walking around, lots of people looking for properties. That's a typical portal play. And I saw that as an incredible amount of potential. This was 1,000 people, but what I could see in my mind is, if this is what 1,000 people, 2,000 people looks like, can you imagine what 1 million people coming to your website looks like? And for me, that was the beginning of a lengthy conversation around where can this organization go? What other touch points can this organization develop? And where can we actually take this? And the first conversations when I walked into the organization were, how do we turn this into more than just a portal business? But how do we turn this into a business that reaches significantly more than just online from a channel perspective, and significantly more than just the people that we're able to reach and touch now? So I'm very attracted to scale. I'm definitely very attracted to problems of this nature. And I seem to have an eye for seeing where potential is. And this business had a lot of potential just from outside. And then when I got inside and started asking the questions, it definitely did confirm that.
That's fantastic. And one of the decisions I know you had to grapple with and to get the team to perhaps look at differently was, how do you define yourself? And who your competition is. So as a portal, that had a one set of answers. But when you started to look at the potential of what the business could be, it looked quite different. Talk to us a little bit about that pivotal decision of no longer seeing yourself as a portal. And what impact has that decision to shift or pivot that aspect of the business had on the potential of the business and ultimately its growth into new spaces?
So the portal has always been and will always be the core of what our business is. But off that are so many spin-offs that if you think about this broadly, there's so many spin-offs that come from having the portal at the heart of it. And the first time I actually said we can be more than a portal, like I could almost see tears dropping within the organization, because it's something that was incredibly strange to a business that had always just been a portal. So let's focus on being a portal. And focus for me is a really important thing. You focus on your core, but you also build peripheral products and services around the core. So as we developed that conversation, I think it became more and more heated within and, of course, within the market. And then we started asking ourselves various uncomfortable questions. Questions like, who's our customer? Questions like, what drives people to come to the website? You know, what other things are, you know, people looking for? And we spent literally days before I joined asking those questions with facilitation of you, Sarah, at the time. Asking those questions around, what is a portal? What does a portal do? But beyond a portal, what can we do? So we started changing the narrative slowly towards being a broader property business than just being a portal. I could see the discomfort right off the bat. What I did see, however, was the potential if we chose to do that. So at the end of those sessions, we made a conscious choice to be more than just a portal. And I think if there's one decision that's benefited us greatly in the last year, especially during these times of COVID, I think it's been that decision. We've stretched out quite a lot, and we're enjoying the journey at the moment.
Yes, certainly sounds like leadership mindset can have a very strong and lasting impact about how you see the opportunity and how willing you are to venture beyond. I certainly remember a lot of these conversations were really deep, and you could see how people through conversation and reflection start to shift and then challenge their own perceptions. I want to bring one more role player into this discussion, and that is the role that boards and that whether advisory boards or the constituted board of an organization play in a transformation of this nature. Talk to us a little bit about what was the role that the board play and how were they helpful in getting the organization to transform to the scale and to the extent that you were already seeing was necessary?
What was really encouraging at the time, and this for me was one of the main reasons I joined, is we had a board that fully understood where the organization was and where they wanted the organization to go. So when they went looking for somebody to run the organization, they were looking for a futurist, if I can put it that way. So it's not a board that was looking for immediate results. It was a board that was looking for transitioning this business over the next 5 years into something that will become a powerhouse. So the beauty of that is it gives the executive team sufficient thinking time, and it gives the executive team sufficient planning time. Because in this day and age, executives have significantly less time to turn things around than what they used to have 10, 15 years ago. Boards have just become incredibly impatient. And I suppose these are the times we live in. But what I saw with our board was the patience of not wanting to maximize profit now, the patience of wanting to build the fundamentals of the organization rather than short-term gain. And that was unanimous across the board. And I must say that as we started the process of, you know, transforming the business, as we started the process of making changes, some of the changes we had to make were quite significant. But if it hadn't been for a supportive board at the time, I think some of those changes would have been very, very difficult to make. So it's also important that, I mean, from my experience, I've had an incredibly supportive board that's given the executive team space and time to work. And for me, that's quite important. So the board executive relationship is a really important one from my point of view. The CEO chairman relationship is an important one. I've been fortunate to have very good relationships with both. So from an advisory perspective, what the board in this case brought was a lot of industry knowledge, which I didn't have at the time. They brought a lot of historical context, which I didn't have at the time. And I think my business flair and the experience brought by the board was just an incredible combination. Still continues to work. And I mean, the support has been incredible. So from a board point of view, in the absence of complete unanimous agreement on what they're looking for and where they see the organization going, it would have been a very difficult mission to take on.
Yeah, certainly. And one of the decisions that I recall was certainly a board decision, or a decision where the board certainly got involved and had to weigh up, was the rebranding of the business, seeing the business that was well recognized, as you've said right at the outset of the conversation. Private Property was a known brand. There was an emotional attachment, even in some quarters, to this brand. People recognized it for something. The decision to rebrand the business was not a insignificant one. Tell us a little bit about that process and what, once the decision was made, what did it allow you to do that under the old Private Property brand was difficult, if not impossible?
So the rebrand was, without a doubt, the biggest decision that Private Property has had to make in, I suppose, decades. Because of where we come from and the rich history that we have, some of it, most of it great, you know, some of it not so great, but because of the history we have and being such a household name, there are various conversations around the brand we started having. One conversation was, do we change the brand completely, including the name? Or do we carry the equity that the name has built up over the years and just change the look and feel and the tone? That debate went on for months. And I think if there's ever been an emotionally charged set of decisions I've ever had to look at, from all the role players I've ever dealt with, this was probably the biggest one. So on one end, you had role players saying it might be useful to just change everything completely, including the name. On the other end, you had role players saying, if you change the name, there's a lot of brand equity that you lose and you'd be starting from the beginning. So we went through a process of doing a thorough analysis. And we arrived at the point that being an online business, doing what we do, the brand equity we built up over the years, it might be better. And we, from statistically and factually what we saw, it's actually better in the long-term interest of the business to continue with the name, but significantly change what the brand looked, felt like, and sounded like. So the brand's tone, the brand's colors, what the brand stands for, the ethos of the brand. And we chose to go back to our original roots and focus significantly on customers. Focus significantly on what our customers are. So if you look at our brand now, this is 3-4 months after rebranding. It's turned out to be one of the better decisions we made, because if we hadn't done that, we had started becoming a very background player that looked like most real estate brands. So the colors we had at the time were blue and red. Those are very popular colors within the industry. And what we didn't do at the time is we didn't stand out. So before you take on the process of innovation and doing significant change, both internally and out and externally, we chose to look, sound, and feel different to our customers. It seems to have been one of the best decisions we've made in the last year. Customers have taken very kindly to it across the board. So whether you're talking about people that use our website, or people that estate agents or other businesses that list with us, it's been received really, really nicely. And you can see from the numbers that it was a worthwhile decision to make. What would have happened if we changed the name? We don't know. I suppose we would never know. But as an online brand, and from all the analysis we did as an online brand, we just felt it would have been a decision that would have had a negative implication on our business. So lots and lots of considerations there. 2 weeks before this rebrand, we sit across the boardroom table, we sit across the executive table, and COVID-19 is creeping up. And we can see it coming in all parts of the globe, literally. And we ask ourselves, if this is what's happening in the globe at the moment, and if this is what's happening in the country, at the time Cape Town had just announced the first case, what do we do? So we sit down and start debating whether we should rebrand or not. And one of the answers was, if we rebrand now, nobody's going to see us because everybody's talking about COVID-19. My call at the time was a difficult one, but the call I made is, let's rebrand now, because there's never a good time or a bad time to do some of these things. the advantage of rebranding then is almost all the brands around us, almost most organizations started pulling back on marketing spend. Our advantage was then that we could acquire advertising space significantly cheaper than what we could have acquired before. And we took that gap and we took a full month of being out there and being fairly loud and being one of very few brands that was advertising at the time. Very unpopular decision to make, but it's a decision we made and we went for it. It turned out to be one of the better strategic decisions we made last year.
Well, I mean, what a great example of counterintuitive thinking, huh? I guess most marketing professionals would tell you otherwise, and I guess you had to use quite a bit of both data and imagination and your own gut feel to come up with what would be the right decision for the organization. You did raise something that I just wanted to amplify a little bit. You spoke about innovation. One of the things that we measure, evaluate, and speak to customers about, and particularly in times of disruption, and this current environment is a wonderfully challenging and at the same time opportune environment to innovate, is we ask them whether they agree or disagree with the statement that they as an organization value and reward innovation, even if it disrupts, or especially if it disrupts their current business or can put current revenue streams at risk. And it's very interesting to see the responses to that particular question when we have this discussion with organizations. So if I had to ask you, I mean, when listening to the decision to rebrand and some of the risks that were apparent in that decision, what are the kind of things that started to creep in that told you that you are innovating? What were the kind of experiences, the team members perhaps, the new solutions that started to popping up that says, if our brand was different, if this is the road we are traveling, and if we're willing and have the courage to take this decision in the midst of this pandemic and seeing the opportunity that it provides, what are the kind of things that started popping up as innovations or being innovative as the new private property?
So I do think, for me, the best time to innovate is when you self-disrupt. And I do think a lot of leaders lack the courage to self-disrupt. So as businesses, we get really comfortable with historical models and we get really comfortable with what we've always been. And comfort is always an enemy of innovation. That's my philosophy. For me, growth is found in the unfamiliar. Innovation is found in the unfamiliar. So the more uncomfortable an environment gets sometimes, the more people are in a position to have to innovate. So you can either wait until the environment tells you you have no choice but to innovate or die, or you can start thinking forward. What we chose to do was to start forward thinking and start looking at disrupting our own mental molds and start looking at disrupting the things that we believe we are by asking all these uncomfortable questions. So we went through quite a process to begin to agree that this route of innovation was that. But we had to, as a leadership team, display display courage for the rest of the organization to see that this was a new way of doing things. And the best place to display courage was the decision to rebrand. So when you look around as a kickstarter for where we want to go, as a kickstarter for the arrival of this new private property, there wasn't a better place and a more public platform to do it than to actually go and do a rebrand. And what we've seen as offshoots of that is people in the business just being a lot more courageous. People in the business taking a lot more risks than they would before. And as we take risks, not being afraid that if you take a risk, something's going to get done to you. Because one of the conversations I had with the marketing team at the time is they were very concerned about us rebranding at this time. And mine was, well, we've made a decision. We're going with the decisions we made. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work, but at least we tried. And if we can do something like that on such a significant decision, you can imagine what how that emboldens everybody else within the organization to begin to take risks. So we've seen, you know, people that may have historically been quiet speak up. We've seen people that would have historically chosen not to give their ideas, give their ideas. We've seen some of, you know, the best innovations come from the quietest people in the organization. And we've just seen people even fix things that they've always known needed to be fixed, but didn't really pick up. So the more of that we've seen, more the culture of innovation has begun to creep up within the organization. You know, feature by feature, product by product, and in some cases, just basic changes within the company. We've always done things this way, let's try and do things that way. Emboldened by the initial steps that we've taken that were courageous. So the danger of that stuff, and I suppose that's why many leaders shy away from it, is if it doesn't work, and a lot of people will go, if it doesn't work, then, you know, we're finished. But there comes a point where you have to bolden up and make some of those decisions. And these decisions obviously need to be informed by some logical thinking. And sometimes it is intuition, but that's what leadership is. Leadership is not about just following things as they've been done before all the time. We learn from the past, but we define what the future looks like. And I just find that the more of those things we do, the more confidence people generate and have in their leadership team, and the more emboldened they become to take risks themselves, which is where innovation logically is birthed. If we give people the freedom to think, we give people the freedom to innovate, the freedom to come up with ideas and accept those ideas, that in itself becomes the truth of what the organization becomes. So we're still walking this journey. We're still all learning, you know, where we're going. We're still all learning what innovation in this organization will look like. But it's great to see that based on some of the bold steps we've taken, people in the organization are following suit and just beginning to raise their hands and innovate and change things.
Amasi, you're certainly alluding to innovation that's being a growing capability within your organization, but really the underlying culture that you're creating in the business and what then becomes possible when you help people unleash themselves and take risks, and what could they achieve when they both got the mental bandwidth to think and reflect, as well as the bandwidth to act and try and experiment. And as you say, not everything is going to succeed, but that just that creating that culture of acceptance and allowing people to play in a different way within the organization must have been quite liberating for people, as I'm hearing it.
It has been. One example I can give is we've always been a portal, an online business. So we made the decision, the property show I was talking about before. So we made the decision to buy it. Now, that decision was a complete left-wing decision for an online business. An online business buying a physical event, which is an expo that brings about thousands of people to come to one place, but it's a physical interaction of your clients. So making that decision and turning people who have always been online thinkers into physical thinkers was probably one of the nicest things I've ever seen from a transformation perspective. So the first show we had was in Cape Town, and how quickly our people transitioned from online thinking to how do we transition this into physical? Because my conversation at the time was, think of this physical show as a representation, a physical representation of what your business looks like online. And our people took that, and a business our size to be able to pull off an expo that the biggest one we had about 15,000 people come to it. When we initially bought it, it was doing about 2,000-3,000 people. But the boldness that our people took from the cue to say you can make these mistakes and you can get out there and do things that are unfancied and different, that became an incredible success. We then moved off to the next one, we would never had, the industry had never had a full, call it a convention or an event. We had never had the industry all come together in one place and just talk about the industry challenges that we had and where the industry is going. So we then organized the Real Estate Industry Summit, again, a physical event. We were oversubscribed for the Real Estate Industry Summit. What we did do is we used our networks, we used our reach into our customers to organize that. That worked really, really well. It was an incredible success. We brought international speakers, and learning from, you know, the likes of Inman and learning from a number of international conventions, we then chose to build a convention for Africa for the real estate industry. Again, the first in the country, hasn't happened before, and we'll continue to build on those things. So not only are we an online business now, we've stretched to the physical. There's obviously the COVID challenge now, but as and when things evolve, we continue to evolve with that. So where are we with those things that we bought? We're now moving them from a physical presence into a digital space, because that's where the world is now. So strategy is not static. Strategy evolves with time, and we'll continue to evolve with that as we go. But those are just two examples of what, you know, emboldening people internally can do when it comes to being able to innovate and being able to be agile in how you execute your strategy.
Not all days are glamorous, though. Talk to us about your worst day on the job.
Worst day on the job. On sport for choice, actually. So, I mean, it's a different industry, and I've been fortunate enough to work in various industries. But what I really, really enjoy about this industry, what makes it really different, is just how passionate the people in the industry are. Really, really passionate people in the industry, passionate about their trade, passionate about what they do. And I think the worst day I had was a particular day when we made a particular decision that I won't go into. And that particular decision affected a sizable chunk of the industry. So the passion that came out of the criticism and backlash we got was quite a lot. We took it on the chin. We rectified the problem that we'd raised at the time. And I suppose we recovered from that. But being on the receiving end of a very passionate industry, when you're on the wrong foot, that's a pretty hard one to take. Second is, and I think for me the most important is, there's a day when I really felt I disappointed the staff that work for us. Our people are very important to us. Our people are very important to me. And there was a particular day when I really felt that I disappointed them in a particular decision that I had made, and I took responsibility for that. So for me, I think there's nothing more difficult than disappointing people and them genuinely having a gripe. So they had an axe to grind with me. I took it on the chin, and I apologize for that. Emotionally, the hardest day was the day we lost a staff member. One of our staff members unfortunately passed in a road accident. That was really tough to navigate the organization through. We have built a business that runs almost like a family, very tight-knit. And having lost a staff member was a really difficult thing for me as the leader, and very difficult for the organization as well. So that was an emotional low.
And I guess you are giving us real richness into the human nature of leadership. The fact that it is messy, and we will make mistakes, but it's how we adapt and continuously learn as part of this process. Sounds like you were very much learning, adapting, and applying as part of this process.
You have to. My experience that I have, I've been fortunate to work in multiple industries, and I try and apply whatever I can apply that worked before, because that's just, we all get better as we grow, especially when it comes to leadership. You never ever arrive. But adapting is also important. So what worked in my previous company and the company before that is not necessarily going to work here. Meaning every single organization you go to, there's an element of experience that you bring, but there's also an element of learning that comes with it. So it's that difficult balance of where am I opening myself up to learn because I don't know, and where am I bringing the experience I have to supplement what's already here. A lot of leaders make the mistake of going from one place to another and copying and pasting what worked in the previous place. This is a different business. It's a different industry completely. So I'm learning to be very open-minded to learning from the people I find and learning from the people I work with. And in this case, one of the very deliberate things I've done is to collect an executive team and bring together a team of people that have varied experience from different industries, none of whom know what the answers are. So we're discovering this thing together and we're learning how this works and we're building something that nobody has built before. So nobody knows the answers. And therein, in my mind, lies the secret to innovation.
I really appreciate this. And this has been such a great conversation. Seeing that this really transverses across industries or even functional domains, what lessons would you want to share or leave our audience with other executives who are navigating in a similar fashion, learning, adapting all at the same time? What would you want to leave with them that you think will be helpful?
So I think if there's one thing COVID's done across the world is shown us how nobody has the answers. The fact that nobody has a cure for COVID means nobody has all the answers. And the fact that it's then disrupted the whole globe, literally, means what will make or break leaders and what will the difference be, what the difference will be between leaders who navigate their businesses out of this and leaders who don't is openness to learning. And openness to learning starts from knowing that you don't know everything and accepting that you don't know everything and being open enough to know that the most junior person in the organization might just have the answer. So for me, it's how do we build the culture where instead of having one or five senior people doing the thinking, how do you build a culture in an organization where if you have 1,000 people, all 1,000 of them are thinking and they feel free enough to be able to bring their thoughts up and they know that those thoughts will be taken seriously and considered. That for me is what will be the difference between organizations that make it now and those who don't. One mind, no matter how clever that mind is, just isn't enough. Because nobody has the answers, global thinking is going to be important, multifaceted thinking is going to be important, and bringing diversity into an organization now more than ever becomes a strength. Diversity means diversity of thinking, diversity of experiences, and different people learn from each other. But the job of the leader becomes to set the tone to make sure that learning from each other actually begins to work for the entire organization. So I've become a student of life, I've become a student of people, I've become a student of leadership, and over the years, that's what continues to carry me.
Masi, thank you for spending your time with us. Wise words. Appreciate all the insights and sharing from your personal journey. For those who've joined us, thank you. Thank you for spending the time with us. I hope it's been helpful. We have more episodes to come. If you want to follow us, please just join us on LinkedIn. You'll see information about our next episodes. Thank you again for the time and be well as we all navigate and learn through the crisis and beyond. Thank you.
Thank you, Sal.
Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Join us next time for more business news, views, and insights from across the globe.